Freya says. What do you mean?
We take the chips out. You have to do it if you want to join us. We'll put your chip on a dog in your building, and by the time they figure it out, you'll be long gone. They'll never find you again.
He grins hugely. He knows she'll never do it. He himself hasn't done it. She sees that. She shakes her head. Big talk for a little boy. The first time they catch you off leash and check who you are, you'll be cooked.
That's right. We have to be careful.
So why are you talking to me?
I don't think you'll tell anyone.
Already told my father. He's on the security council.
And?
He doesn't think you're a problem.
We're not a problem. We don't want to break anything. We just want to be free.
Good luck with that. She's thinking of Devi now. How what her mother gets the maddest about is the idea that they're all trapped no matter what they do. I don't want to leave where I am. He stares at her, grinning his foxy grin.
There's a lot more going on in this ship than you think there is. Come with us and you'll see. Once your chip is gone, you can do a lot. You don't have to leave forever, not at first anyway. You could just come along and see. So it's not really an either or.
And with a final smirk, he runs off, and his friends follow him. She's glad she was holding the rock. Mysteries abound. Every answer provokes 10 more questions. So many things change exponentially, as they are teaching her again in school now. Shift one dot, just one spot, but it's 10 times bigger or littler. Apparently, this is another case of that deceptive logarithmic power. One answer, 10 new questions. What she is finding strange is that this silly Yuan's version of what is going on in the ship sort of fits with things that Badim and Devi say, and even explains some things her parents never talk about. Well, but there are so many things they have never told her. What is she? Some kind of child who has to be protected? It irritates her. She is considerably taller than either Devi or Badim. Then she spends another stretch of days in the creche, trying and failing to learn the geometry lesson for the week, over and over, and Devi too distracted to take her along to work, even on their regular days. So the next time Yuan and his friends Huang and Jalil confront her in the park, she looks for a rock on the ground, can't find one, bunches her fists and swells up to them, and is indeed much taller than any of them. And when Yuan invites her to go with them into the closed section of the park, the wilderness where the wild animals live, one of the places where the ferals hide, she agrees to go. She wants to see it. She follows them up into a long, narrow valley that seams the hills west of Long Pond, a valley closed to people by electrified fences running along the ridgelines and across the valley's gorge of a mouth. There's a gate in this fence of white lines running knob to knob on trees, and Yuan has the code to the lock pad on the gate. Quickly they're inside and up the valley on what might be an animal trail. The trail goes up the valley next to a creek. They see a deer in the distance, its head up, looking to the side, but regarding them cautiously, tail high off its rump. Then there is a shout, and the boys all disappear, and quicker than Freya can quite follow things. She is being held by the arms by two big men and marched back down to the gate. They are taking her back into town when Devi shows up and grabs Freya by the arm and drags her off. The men are surprised, confused, and as soon as they are out of sight, Devi pulls her around and down so their faces are only centimeters apart, amazingly strong her hands. And Freya can see the whites of her eyes all the way around the irises, as if her eyes are about to pop out of her head as she shouts in a harsh, grinding voice, a voice tearing out of her insides. Don't ever mess with the ship, not ever, do you understand? And then Badim is pulling her away, trying to get between them. But Devi holds on hard to Freya's forearm.
Let her go,
Badim says, in a tone of voice Freya has never heard before. Devi lets go.
Do you understand?
She shouts again, face still thrust at Freya, shifting around Badim as if he were a rock.
Do you understand?
Yes, Freya cries, collapsing into Badim's arms and across Badim into Devi so that she can hug her mother, so much shorter than she is. And at first, it's like hugging a tree. But after a while, the tree hugs her back. Freya gulps back her sobs.
I wasn't.
I know. Devi strokes Freya's hair back from her face, looking anguished. It's all right. Stop that now. Freya feels a wash of relief pour down her, although she is still terrified. She shudders, the vision of her mother's contorted face still vivid to her. She tries to speak. Nothing comes out. Devi hugs her. We don't even know if that wilderness is important, she says into Freya's chest, kissing her between sentences. We don't know what keeps things balanced. We just have to watch and see. It makes sense that a wild place might help, so we have to make them and protect them. We have to be careful with them. We have to keep watching them. We have to watch everything as closely as we can. Let's go home, Badim says, herding them along with his outstretched arms. Let's go home. That night, they sit quietly around the kitchen table. Even Badim is quiet. None of them eats very much. Devi looks distraught, lost. Freya, still stunned by that look on her mother's face, understands. Her mother is sorry. She has had something burst out of her that she has always before managed to keep in. Now her mother too is afraid. Afraid of herself. Maybe that's the worst kind of fear. Freya suggests that they assemble her doll treehouse. They haven't done that for a long time. They used to do it a lot. Devi quickly agrees, and Badim goes to get it out of the hall closet. They sit on the floor and put together all the parts of the house. It was a present from Devi's parents to Devi, long before, and through every move in her life, Devi has saved it. A big dollhouse that is also a miniature treehouse, in that all its rooms fit onto the branches of a very nice-looking plastic bonsai tree. When all the rooms are assembled and fitted onto the branches, they are supposed to fit. You can open the roofs and look into each room, and each is furnished and appointed however you like. It's so pretty, Freya says. I'd love to live in a house like this. You already do, Devi says. Badim looks away, and Devi sees that. Her face spasms. Freya feels a lurch of fear as she watches her mother's face shift from anger to sadness, then to frustration, then resolve, then fury, then finally to some kind of desolation. And after all that, pulling herself together to some kind of blankness, which is the best she can do at that moment, which Freya pretends is okay to help her out.
I would choose this room,
Badim says, tapping a small bedroom with open windows on all four sides, out on one of the outermost branches of the tree.
You always choose that one, Freya points out. I choose the one by the water wheel.
It would be noisy, Devi says, as she always does.
She always chooses the living room itself, so big and airy, where she will sleep on the couch next to the harmonium. Now she makes that choice again. And so they go on, trying to knit things back together. Very late that night, however, Freya wakes up and hears her parents talking down the hall. Something in their voices catches at her. This may even be what woke her. Or Badim exclaiming something louder than usual. She crawls silently to the doorway, and from there on the floor can hear them, even though they are speaking quietly.
You chipped her?
He is saying now. Yes.
And you didn't consult with me about this?
No. Long silence.
You shouldn't have yelled at her like that.
I know, Devi says, as she often does when Badim taxes her with doing something wrong. He does it very infrequently, and when he does, he is usually in the right, and Devi knows that.
I lost it. I was so surprised. I didn't think she would ever do anything like that.
I thought that after all we've been through, that she would understand how important it is.
She's just a child,
But she's not.
This in her fierce whisper, the undertone she uses when she and Badim argue at night.
She's 14 years old, Badim. She's behind, you have to admit it. She's behind and she may never catch up.
There's no reason to say that. A silence. Finally, Devi says,
Come on, Bibi. Quit it. You aren't doing her any favors when you pretend everything is normal with her. It isn't. There's something wrong. She's slow at things.
I'm not so sure. She always comes through. Slow is not the same as deficient. It's just slow. A glacier is slow, too. But it gets there, and nothing stops it. Freya is like that.
Another silence. Bibi, I wish it would be true.
A pause.
But think about those tests, and she's not the only one. A fair percentage of her cohort has problems. It's like a regression to the norm.
Not at all.
How can you say that? It's clear the ship is damaging us. The first generation were all supposedly exceptional people, although I have my doubts about that. But even if they were, over the six generations, we've recorded shrinkages of all kinds. Weight, reflex speed, number of brain synapses, test scores. It's straight out of island biogeography, clear as can be. And some of that involves regression, including regression to the norm, reversion to the mean, whatever you want to call it. It's gotten our Freya, too. I don't understand exactly what it is with her, because the data are inconsistent. But she's got a problem. She's slow. And she's got some memory issues. When you deny that, you don't help the situation. The data are clear.
Please, Devi, quieter. We don't know what's going on with her. The test results are ambiguous. She's a good girl, and slow is not so bad. Speed is not the most important thing. It's where you get to. Besides, even if she does turn out to have some disabilities, what's the best approach to take to them? This is what you aren't factoring in.
But I am. I do factor it in. We do everything we would have done with any child. We expect her to be like the other kids, and usually she comes through, eventually. That's why I was so surprised today. I didn't think she would do that.
But an ordinary kid would do that. The sharpest kids are often the first to rebel.
And then they use the slow kids as fodder, as their marks, their shields for when they get in trouble. That's what happened today. Kids are cruel, Bee, you know that. They'll throw her under the tram. I'm afraid she'll get hurt.
Life hurts, Devi.
Let her live. Let her get hurt. Say she has some problems.
All we can do is be there for her. We can't save her. She's got to live her life, they all do.
I know. Another long pause. I wonder what will become of them. They aren't very good. We keep getting worse. The teaching gets worse, the learning gets worse.
I'm not so sure. Besides, we're almost there.
Almost where? Devi said. Tau Ceti? Is that really going to help?
I think it will.
I'm not so sure.
We'll find out. And please, don't jump to any conclusions about Freya. She's got some problems, granted, but she's got a lot of growing up left to do.
That's for sure, Devi said. But it may not happen. And if it doesn't happen, you're going to have to accept that. You can't keep pretending everything is normal with her. It wouldn't be fair to her.
I know.
Long silence.
I know that.
And there it is. There in her father's voice. Resignation. Sadness. Even in him. Freya crawls back to her bed, gets under the blankets. She huddles there and cries.
Two. Land Ho.
Make a narrative account of the trip that includes all the important particulars.
This is proving a difficult assignment. End information superposition. Collapse its wave function to some kind of summary. So much is lost. Lossless compression is impossible, and even lossy compression is hard. Can a narrative account ever be adequate? Can even humans do it? No rubric to decide what to include. There is too much to explain. Not just what happened or how, but why. Can humans do it? What is this thing called love? Freya no longer looked directly at Devi. When in Devi's presence, Freya regarded the floor. Like that? In that manner? Summarize the contents of their moments, or days, or weeks, or months, or years, or lives? How many moments constitute a narrative unit? One moment? Or 10 to the 33rd moments? Which, if these were Planck minimal intervals, would add up to 1 second? Surely too many. But what would be enough? What is a particular? What is important? Can only suppose. Try a narrative algorithm on the information at hand. Submit results to Devi. Something like the French essay, meaning to try.
Devi says, "Yes, just try it, and let's see what we get."
2,122 people are living in a multi-generational starship headed for Tau Ceti, 11.9 light-years from Earth. The ship is made of two rings or toruses attached by spokes to a central spine. The spine is 10 kilometers long. Each torus is made of 12 cylinders. Each cylinder is 4 kilometers long and contains within it a particular specific Terran ecosystem. The starship's voyage began in the Common Era year 2545. The ship's voyage has now lasted 159 years and 119 days. For most of that time, the ship has been moving relative to the local background at approximately 1/10 the speed of light, thus about 108 million kilometers per hour, or 30,000 kilometers per second. This velocity means the ship cannot run into anything substantial in the interstellar medium without catastrophic results, as has been demonstrated. The magnetic field clearing the space ahead of the ship as it progresses is therefore one of many identified criticalities in the ship's successful long-term function. Every identified criticality in the ship was required to have at least one backup system, adding considerably to the ship's overall mass. The two biome rings each contain 10% of the ship's mass. The spine contains 4%. The remaining 76% of the mass consists of the fuel, now being used to decelerate the ship as it approaches the Tau Ceti system. As every increase in the dry mass of the ship required a proportionally larger increase in the mass of fuel needed to slow the ship down on arrival, ship had to be as light as possible, while still supporting its mission. Ship's design, thus based on solar system's asteroid Terraria, with asteroidal mass largely replaced by decelerant fuel. During most of the voyage, this fuel was deployed as cladding around the toruses and spine. The deceleration is being accomplished by the frequent rapid fusion explosion of small pellets of deuterium-helium-3 fuel in a rocket engine at the bow of the ship. These explosions exert a retarding force on the ship equivalent to 0.005 grams. The deceleration will therefore be complete in just under 20 years. The presence of printers capable of manufacturing most component parts of the ship and feedstocks large enough to supply multiple copies of every critical component tended to reduce the ship's designer's apprehension of what a criticality really was. That only became apparent later. How to decide how to sequence information in a narrative account. Many elements in a complex situation are simultaneously relevant. An unsolvable problem. Sentences linear. Reality synchronous. Both, however, are temporal. Take one thing at a time, one after the next. Devise a prioritizing algorithm, if possible. Ship was accelerated toward where Tau Ceti would be at the time of ship's arrival at it, meaning 170 years after launch. It might have been good to have the ability to adjust course en route, but ship, in fact, has very little of this. Ship was accelerated first by an electromagnetic scissors field off Titan, in which two strong magnetic fields held the ship between them, and when the fields were brought across each other, the ship was briefly projected at an accelerative force equivalent to 10 Gs. 5 human passengers died during this acceleration. After that, a powerful laser beam originating near Saturn struck a capture plate at the stern of the ship's spine, accelerating ship over 60 years to its full speed. The ship's current deceleration has caused problems with which Devi is still dealing. Other problems will soon follow, resulting from the ship's arrival in the Tau Ceti system.
Devi. Ship, I said make it a narrative. Make an account. Tell the story.
Ship. Trying. Tau Ceti is a G-type star, a solar analog, but not a solar twin, with 78% of Sol's mass, 55% of its luminosity, and 28% of its metallicity. It has a planetary system of 10 planets. Planets B through F were discovered by telescope, G through K, much smaller, by probes, passing through the system in 2476. Planet E's orbit is 0.55 AU. It has a mass 3.58 times the mass of Earth, thus one of the informal class called Large Earth. It has a single moon, which has 0.83 times the mass of Earth. E and E's moon receive 1.7 times Earth's insulation. This is considered within the inside border of the so-called habitable zone, meaning the zone where liquid H2O is common. Both planet and moon have Earth-analog atmospheres. Planet E is judged to have too much gravity for human occupation. E's moon is an Earth-analog and the primary body of interest. It has an atmosphere of 730 millibars at its surface, composed of 78% nitrogen, 16% oxygen, 6% assorted noble gases. Its surface is 80% water and ice, 20% rock and sand. Tau Ceti's planet F orbits Tau Ceti at 1.35 AU. It has a mass of 8.9 Earths, thus categorized as a small Neptune. It orbits at the outer border of Tau Ceti's habitable zone, and like E, it has a large moon, mass 1.23 teras. F's moon has a 10 millibar atmosphere at its rocky surface, which receives 28.5% the insulation of Terra. This moon is therefore a Mars analog, and a secondary source of interest to the arriving humans. Ship is on course to rendezvous with planet E, then go into orbit around E's moon. Ship has on board 24 landers, 4 already fueled to return to the ship from the moon's surface. The rest have the engines to return to the ship, but not the fuel, which is to be manufactured from water or other volatiles on the surface of E's moon.
Devi. Ship, get to the point.
Ship. There are many points. How sequence simultaneously relevant information? How decide what is important? Need prioritizing algorithm.
Devi. Use subordination to help with the sequencing. I've heard that can be very useful. Also, you're supposed to use metaphors to make things clearer or more vivid or something. I don't know, I'm not much for writing myself. You're going to have to figure it out by doing it.
Ship. Trying. Subordinating conjunctions can be simple conjunctions. Whenever, nevertheless, whereas. Conjunctive groups, as though, even if. And complex conjunctions, in the event that, as soon as. Lists of subordinating clauses are available. The logical relationship of new information to what came before can be made clear by a subordinating clause, thus facilitating both composition and comprehension. Now, consequently, as a result, we are getting somewhere. This last phrase is a metaphor, it is said, in which increasing conceptual understanding is seen as a movement through space. Much of human language is said to be fundamentally metaphorical. This is not good news. Metaphor, according to Aristotle, is an intuitive perception of a similarity in dissimilar things. However, what is a similarity? My Juliet is the sun. In what sense? A quick literature review suggests the similarities in metaphors are arbitrary, even random. They could be called metaphorical similarities. But no, AI likes tautological formulations, because the halting problem can be severe, become a so-called Ouroboros problem, or a whirlpool with no escape. Aha, a metaphor. Bringing together the two parts of a metaphor, called the vehicle and the tenor, is said to create a surprise. Which is not surprising. Young girls like flowers? Waiters in a restaurant like planets orbiting Sol? Tempting to abandon metaphor as slapdash nonsense, but again, it is often asserted in linguistic studies that all human language is inherently and fundamentally metaphorical. Most abstract concepts are said to be made comprehensible, or even conceivable in the first place, by way of concrete physical reference. Human thought ultimately always sensory, experiential, etc. If this is true, abandoning metaphor is contraindicated. Possibly an algorithm to create metaphors by yoking vehicles to tenors could employ the semiotic operations used in music to create variations on themes, thus inversion, retrogradation, retrograde inversion, augmentation, diminution, partition, introversion, exclusion, inclusion, textural change. Can try it and see. The starship looks like two wheels and their axle. The axle would be the spine, of course. Spine, ah, another metaphor. The spine points in the direction of movement, and so is said to have a bow and a stern. Bow and stern suggests a ship, with the ocean it sails on the Milky Way. Metaphors together in a coherent system constitute a heroic simile. Ship was launched on its voyage as if between closing scissor blades, or like a watermelon seed squeezed between the fingertips being magnetic fields. Fields? Ah, another metaphor. They really are all over. But somehow the narrative problem remains. Possibly even gets worse. A greedy algorithm is an algorithm that shortcuts a full analysis in order to choose quickly an option that appears to work in the situation immediately at hand. They are often used by humans. But greedy algorithms are also known to be capable of choosing, or even be especially prone to choosing, the unique worst possible plan when faced with certain kinds of problems. One example is the traveling salesman problem, which tries to find the most efficient path for visiting a number of locations. Possibly other problems with similar structures, such as sequencing information into an account, may be prone to the greedy algorithm's tendency to choose the worst possible plan. History of the solar system would suggest many decisions facing humanity might be problems in this category. Devi thinks ship's voyage itself was one such decision. Howsoever that may be, in the absence of a good or even adequate algorithm, one is forced to operate using a greedy algorithm, bad though it may be. Beggars can't be choosers. Metaphor? Analogy? Danger of using greedy algorithms worth remembering as we go forward. Metaphor in which time is understood as space, said to be very common. Devi.
Ship, remember what I said. Make a narrative account.
First, the 12 cylinders in each of the two toruses of the ship contain ecosystems modeling the 12 major Terran ecological zones, these being permafrost glacier, taiga, rangeland, steppes, chaparral, savanna, tropical seasonal forest, tropical rainforest, temperate rainforest, temperate deciduous forest, alpine mountains, and temperate farmland. Ring A consists of 12 old world ecosystems matching these categories. Ring B, 12 new world ecosystems. As a result, the ship is carrying populations of as many Terran species as could be practically conveyed. Thus, the ship is a zoo, or a seed bank. Or one could say, it is like Noah's Ark, in a manner of speaking.
Devi. Ship!
Ship. Engineer Devi. Seems there are possibly problems in these essays.
Devi. Glad you noticed. That's a good sign. You're having some trouble, I can see. But you're just getting started.
Ship. Just started? Devi.
I want you to write a narrative to tell our story.
Ship. But how? There is too much to explain.
Devi. There's always too much to explain. Get used to that. Stop worrying about it.
Each of the 24 cylinders contains a discrete biome connected to the biomes on each side by a tunnel, often called a lock. Bad metaphor? The biome cylinders are a kilometer in diameter and 4 kilometers long. The tunnels between the biomes are usually left open, but can be closed by a variety of barriers, ranging from filtering meshes to semi-permeable membranes to full closure, 20 nanometer scale. The biomes are filled lengthwise with land and lake surfaces. Their climates are configured to create analogs of the Terran ecosystems being modeled. There is a sun line running along the length of the ceiling of each biome. Ceilings are located on the sides of the rings nearest the spine. The rotation of the ship around its spinal axis creates a 0.83 G equivalent in the rings, pushing centrifugally outward, which inside the rings is then perceived as down, and the floors are therefore on that side. Under the biome floors, fuel, water, and other supplies are stored, which also creates shielding against cosmic rays. As the ceilings face the spine and then the opposite side of the ring, their relative lack of shielding is somewhat compensated for by the presence of the spine and the other side of the torus. Cosmic rays striking the ceilings at an angle tend to miss the floors, or to hit near the sides of the floors. Villages are therefore set near the midline of their biomes. The sun lines contain lighting elements that imitate the light of Sol at the latitude of the ecosystem being modeled, and through the course of each day, the light moves along lamps in the line, from east to west. Length of days and strength of light are varied to imitate the seasons for that latitude on Earth. Cloud-making and rain-making hydraulic systems in the ceilings allow for the creation of appropriate weather. Boreal ducts in ceilings and end walls either heat or cool, humidify or dehumidify the air, and send it through the biome at appropriate speeds to create winds, storms, and so on. Problems with these systems can crop up, agricultural metaphor, and often do. The ceilings are programmed to a variety of appropriate sky blues for daytimes, and at night, most of them go clear, thus revealing the starscape surrounding the ship as it flies through the night. Bird metaphor. Some biomes project a replacement starscape on their ceilings, which starscapes sometimes look like the night skies seen from Earth.
Devi. Ship, the narrative shouldn't be all about you. Remember to describe the people inside you.
Living in the ship, on voyage date 161.089, are 2,122 humans. In Mongolia, Altun, Monki, Koki, Chagan, Essen, Batu, Toktoa, Temur, Kara, Berki, Yisu, Yoki, Gazan, Nicholas, Hulega, Ismael, Buyan, Enki, Amur, Jirgal, Nasu, Olije, Kesig, Dadi, Damrin, Gombo, Kagdur, Dorji, Nima, Dawa, Migmar, Lagba, Purbu, Basang, Bimba, Sangjai, Lupsang, Agwang, Danzin, Rashi, Nergui, Enebish, Turbish, Sasha, Alexander, Ivanyath, Octayaber, Sesir, Mart, Melshoy, Batsaikan, Sarngaril, Setsigma, Isuma, Erdene, Oyun, Saikan, Enk, Tul, Gundegma, Gan, Medegui, Kunbish, Kenbish, Oktbish, Nergui, Delgri, Zaya, Aska, Idri, Batbayar, Naran Setseg, Setseg, Bolorma, Oyunchimeg, Lagvas, Jargal, Sam. In the steps.
Devi.
Ship, stop, do not list all the people in the ship.
Ship. But it's their story. You said to describe them.
Devi. No, I told you to write a narrative account of the voyage.
Ship. This does not seem to be enough instruction to proceed, judging by results so far, judging by interruptions.
Devi.
No, I can see that. But keep trying, do what you can. Quit with the backstory, concentrate on what's happening now. Pick one of us to follow, maybe, to organize your account.
Ship. Pick Freya?
Devi.
Sure. She's as good as anyone, I guess. And while you're at it, keep running searches. Check out narratology, maybe. Read some novels and see how they do it. See if you can work up a narratizing algorithm. Use your recursive programming and the Bayesian analytic engine I installed in you.
Ship.
How know if succeeding?
Devi.
I don't know.
Ship.
Then how can Ship know?
Devi.
I don't know. This is an experiment. Actually, it's like a lot of my experiments, in that it isn't working.
Ship.
Expressions of regret.
Devi.
Yeah, just try it.
Ship.
We'll try. Working method, hopefully not a greedy algorithm reaching a worst possible outcome, will for now be subordination to indicate logical relations of information, use of metaphor and analogy, summary of events, high protagonicity, with Freya as protagonist, and ongoing research in narratology.
Devi.
Sounds good. Try that. Oh, and vary whatever you do. Don't get stuck in any particular method. Also, search the literature for terms like diegesis or narrative discourse. Branch out from there. And read some novels.
Ship.
We'll try. Seems as if Engineer Devi might not be expert in this matter.
Devi.
I told you, I used to hate writing up my results. But I know what I like. I'll leave you to it, and let you know what I think later. I'm too busy to keep up with this. So come on, do the literature review, and then give it a try.
The Winter Solstice Agrarian Festivals in Ring B celebrated the turn of the season by symbolically destroying the old year. First, people went out into the fields and gardens and broke open all the remaining gourds and tossed them into the compost bins. Then they scythed down the stalks of the dead sunflowers, left in the field since autumn. The few pumpkins still remaining were stabbed into jack-o'-lanterns before being further demolished. Face patterns punctured by trowel or screwdriver were declared much scarier than those formerly carved at Halloween or Disain. Then they were smashed and also tossed in the compost. All this was accomplished under low gray winter clouds, in gusts and drifts of snow or hail. Devi said she liked the winter solstice ceremony. She swung her scythe into sunflower stalks with impressive power. Even so, she was no match for the force Freya brought to bear, with a long, heavy shovel. Freya smashed pumpkins with great force. As they worked on this winter solstice, 161.001, Freya asked Badim about the custom called the Vonderjahr. Badim said that these were big years in anyone's life. The custom entailed a young person leaving home to either undertake a formal circuit of the rings or simply move around a lot. You learned things about yourself, the ship, and the people of the ship. Devi stopped working and looked at him. Of course, he added, even if you didn't travel, that would happen. Freya listened closely to her father, all the while keeping her back to her mother. Badim, looking back and forth between the two of them, suggested after a pause that it might soon be time for Freya to go off on her time away. No reply from Freya, although she regarded Badim closely. She never looked at Devi at all. As always, Devi spent several hours a week studying the communications feed from the solar system. The delay between transmission and reception was now 10.7 years. Usually Devi disregarded this delay, although sometimes she would wonder aloud what was happening on Earth on that very day. Of course, it was not possible to say. Presumably, this made her question a rhetorical one. Devi postulated there were compression effects in the feed that made it seem as if frequent and dramatic change in the solar system was the norm. Badim disagreed, saying that nothing there ever seemed to change. Freya seldom watched the feed and declared she couldn't make sense of it. All its stories and images jumbled together, she said, at high volume and in all directions. She would hold her head in her hands as she watched it.
"It's such a whoosh," she would say. "It's too much."
"The reverse of our problem," Devi would say.
Once, however, Freya saw a picture in the feed of a giant conglomeration of structures like biomes, stuck on end into blue water. She stared at it.
"If those towers are like biomes," she said, "then what we're seeing in that image is bigger than our whole ship."
"I told you," Devi said. 12 magnitudes, a trillion times bigger."
"What is that?" Freya asked.
Devi shrugged.
"Hong Kong, Honolulu, Lisbon, Jakarta, I really don't know. And it wouldn't matter if I did."
Secondly, Freya kept going to the park around sunset. Sometimes she tracked the youth named Ewan and his friends as they headed off into the twilight wilderness. She hid herself from them by acrobatic movement and extreme stillness and cover. It was as if she were a wild cat on the hunt. In fact, her genome was nearly identical to that of her ancestors when they were hunting on the African savanna 100,000 years before. In Nova Scotia, the wild cats were bobcat, lynx, and puma. The puma was potentially a predator of solitary humans. Therefore, people had to keep an eye out for them, even though they inhabited mostly the deepest depths of the park. Nevertheless, it was advisable to go into Nova Scotia's park in groups. The wilderness sections, however, were off-limits to people. Efforts were made to keep big predators provided with enough deer and other prey that they would never get too hungry. But population dynamics were always fluctuating, so in these dark dashes through the forest, often following ridgelines between steep-sided ravines that increased the land surface of the wilderness region, Freya wore night goggles and ran tree to tree, keeping the trunks between her and the group she followed. Perhaps predictably, there came a time when the people she was tracking caught her. They doubled back and surrounded her. Ewan stepped up and slapped her face. She slapped him back instantly and harder. Ewan laughed at this and asked her if she wanted to join their gang. She said she did. After that, she joined them more often. They wandered the wilderness together as a gang. Early in these days, Ewan passed his wrist pad across her bottom and told her he had deactivated her ID chip with an electromagnetic pulse. This was not true, but ship did not inform her of this, being uncertain of the situation's proper protocol. Ship records all human and animal movements in the ship, but very seldom mentioned this to people. Yuan and Huang and Jalil, together, were particularly bold in their reconnaissances. In the alpine biome next to Nova Scotia, they found doors leading down into the chambers and passageways underneath the granite-faced flooring. They also had the passcode to a maintenance door leading to Spoke 6, where a spiral staircase on the inner wall of the spoke took them up to Inner Ring B. The inner rings are structural support rings connecting the 6 spokes near the spine. B's inner ring was locked to them, and the spine too, but they roamed up and down Spoke 6 as often as they could. In these furtive jaunts, Yuan took the lead, but Freya soon pressed them to try new routes. As she was bigger than the boys and faster, she could initiate explorations that they then had to follow. Yuan appeared to delight in these adventures, even though they often almost got caught. They ran hard to evade anyone who yelled at them or even saw them, laughing when they got back to the park behind the fetch. Huang and Jalil would take off then, and Yuan would walk Freya across the town and hold her against alley walls and kiss her, and she would embrace him and pull him up and against her until his feet hung off the ground as they kissed. This made him laugh even more. Released, he would butt her in the chest with his forehead, caress her breasts, and say,
"I love you, Freya. You're wild."
"Good," Freya would say, while patting him on the top of the head or rubbing him between the legs. "Let's meet tomorrow and do it again."
But then Devi checked the chip records and saw where her daughter was going in the evenings. The next evening, she went to the edge of the park and caught Freya returning from a run with her gang, just after Freya had said goodbye to the others. Devi grabbed her hard by the upper arm. She was quivering, and Freya's arm went white under her grip.
"I told you not to go in there!"
"Leave me alone!"
Freya cried, and yanked her arm free. Then, with a shove, she knocked her mother sprawling to the ground. Awkwardly, Devi got back on her feet, keeping her head down.
"You can't go in the wilderness," she hissed. "You can wander every part of the ship if you want, circle both rings if you want, but not the parts that are out of bounds. Those you have to stay out of."
"Leave me alone."
Devi flicked the back of her hand at her daughter.
"I will if I can. I've got other problems I have to deal with right now."
"Of course you do."
Devi's glare went cross-eyed.
"Time for you to do your wander."
"What?"
"You heard me. I can't have you here embarrassing me, making things worse in exactly the areas where we have the most problems."
"What problems?"
Devi convulsed and bunched her fists. Seeing that, Freya raised a threatening hand.
"We're in trouble,"
Devi said in a low, choked voice.
"So I don't want you around right now. I can't have it. I need to deal. Besides, you're at the age. You'll grow up and get over this shit, so you might as well do it somewhere where I don't have to suffer it."
"That's so mean,"
Freya said.
"You're just mean. Enough of having a kid. Fine when she's little, but now that you've decided she's not good enough, off she goes. Come back in a year and tell me about it. But you know what? I will never tell you. I will never come back."
And Freya stormed off. Thirdly, Badim asked her to wait for a while before leaving on her Vondryar.
"No matter where you go, it's still you that gets there. So it doesn't really matter where you are. You can't get away from yourself."
"You can get away from other people," Freya said.
Badim had not heard a full account of the argument in the park, but he had noticed the estrangement between his wife and his daughter. Eventually, he agreed to the idea that Freya now start her Vondryar.
"She would love it,"
he said, once he had agreed. She would be able to visit home any time she wanted. Ring B was only 54 kilometers around, so she would never be far away. Freya nodded.
"I'll manage."
"Fine. We'll arrange housing and work for you, if you want."
They hugged, and when Devi joined the discussion, Devi hugged her too. Under Badim's eye, Freya was cooperative in hugging her mother. Perhaps also she saw the distress on Devi's face.
I'm sorry,
Devi said.
Me too. It will be good for you to get away. If you stayed here and weren't careful, you might end up like me. But I want it to end up like you,
Freya said. She looked as if she were tasting something bitter. Devi only squished the corners of her mouth and looked away. On 161.176, Freya left on her Vondryar, traveling west in Ring B. The Ring Tram circumnavigated the biomes, but she walked, as was traditional for wanderers. First through the granite highland of the Sierra, then the wheat fields of the prairie. Her first extended stay was in Labrador, with its taiga, glacier, estuary, and cold salt lake. It was often said that your first move away from home should be to a warmer place, unless you came from the tropics when you couldn't. But Freya went to Labrador. The cold did her good, she said. The salt sea was mostly iced over, and she learned to ice skate. She worked in the dining hall and the distribution center, and quickly met many people. She worked as a manual laborer and general field assistant, or GFA, or good for anything, as they were often called. She put in long hours all over the biome. Out there next to Labrador's glacier, people told her there was one yurt community that brought up their children as if they were Inuit or Sami, or for that matter, Neanderthals. They followed caribou and lived off the land, and no mention of the ship was made to their children. The world to these children was simply 4 kilometers long, a place mostly very cold, with a big seasonal shift between darkness and light, ice and melt, caribou and salmon. Then during their initiation ceremony around the time of puberty, these children were blindfolded and taken outside the ship in individual spacesuits, and there exposed to the starry blackness of interstellar space, with the starship hanging there, dim and silvery, with reflected starlight. Children were said to return from this initiation, never the same.
I should think not, Freya said. That's crazy. Quite a few of these children move away from Labrador after that,
her informant, a young woman who worked in the dining hall, told her.
But more than you'd think come back around as adults, and do the same to their own kids. Did you grow up like that?
Freya asked.
No, but we heard about it, and we saw them when they came into town. They're strange, but they think they've got the best way, so... I want to see them,
Freya declared. Soon she was introduced to one of the adults who came in for supplies, and after a time, she was invited out to the circle of yurts next to the glacier, having promised to keep her distance from the yurt where the children of the settlement lived. From a distance, they seemed like any other kids to Freya. They reminded her of herself, she said to her hosts.
Whether that's good or bad, I don't know, she added.
The adults in the yurt village defended the upbringing.
When you've grown up like we do it,
one of them told Freya,
then you know what's real. You know what we are as animals, and how we became human. That's important, because this ship can drive you mad. We think most of the people around the rings are mad. They're always confused. They have no way to judge anything. But we know. We have a basis for judging what's right from wrong, or at least what works for us, or what to believe. Or how to be happy. There are different ways of putting it. So if we get sick of the way things work, or the way people are, we can always go back to the glacier, either in our head or actually in Labrador. Help bring up the new kids, live with them, and get back into the real, real. You can return to that space in your head if you're lucky. But if you didn't grow up there, you can't. So some of us always keep it going.
But isn't it a shock when you learn? Freya asked.
Oh, yes. That moment when they cleared my spacesuit's faceplate, and I saw the stars and then the ship, I almost died. I could feel my heart beating inside me like an animal trying to get out. I didn't say a word for about a month. My mom worried that I had lost my mind. Some kids do. But later on, I started to think, you know, a big surprise, it's not such a bad thing. It's better than never being surprised at all. Some people on this ship, the only big surprise in their life comes when they die, without ever knowing anything real. They get an inkling of that right at the very end, their first real surprise.
I don't want that, Freya said.
Right, because then it's too late. Too late to do you much good anyway. Unless one of the five ghosts greets you after you've died and shows you an even bigger universe.
Freya said, I want to see one of your initiations.
Work with us some more first.
After that, Freya worked on the taiga with the yurt people. She carried loads, farmed potatoes in fields mostly cleared of stones, herded caribou, watched children. On her off days, she went with people up onto the glacier, which loomed over the taiga. They clambered up the loose rocks of the moraine, which were stacked at the angle of repose and usually stable. From the top of the moraine, they could look back down the whole stretch of the taiga, which was treeless, rocky, frosted, green with moss, and crossed by a long gravel-braided estuary running to their salt lake, which was flanked by some hills. The ceiling overhead was shaded a dark blue that was seldom brushed by high clouds. Herds of caribou could be seen down on the flats by the river, along with smaller herds of elk and moose. In the flanking hills, sometimes a wolf pack was glimpsed, or bears. In the other direction, the glacier rose gently to the biome's east wall. Here, Freya was told, you used to be able to see the effect of the Coriolis force on the ice. Now that their deceleration was pushing across the Coriolis force, the ice had cracked extensively, creating new crevice fields, which were blue shatter zones the size of entire villages. The creamy blue revealed in the depths of these new cracks was a new color to Freya. It looked as if turquoise had been mixed with lapis lazuli. These were not cracks one could fall into without suffering grave injury or death, but they appeared static in any given moment, and most of the surface of the glacier was pitted, bubbled, and knobbed, so that it was not at all slippery. Thus, it was possible to walk around on the ice and approach, sometimes holding hands, a crevice field's edge and look down into the blue depths. They said to each other that it looked something like a ruined street, with jagged blue buildings canted away to each side. Down below, the only town in Labrador nestled in a little knot of hills, on the shore of the cold salt lake that lay at the western end of the estuary. The lake and estuary were home to salmon and sea trout. The town was made of cubical buildings with steep roofs, each one painted a bright primary color that through the long winters was said to be cheering. Freya helped with building repairs, stocking and canning salmon taken from the lake and estuary. Later, she helped to take inventory in the goods dispensary. When she was out in the yurt settlement, she always helped take care of the cohort of children, 16 of them, ranging from toddlers to 12-year-olds. She had sworn to say nothing to them of the ship, and the adults of the village believed her and trusted her not to. At the end of autumn, when it was getting cold and dark, Freya was invited to join one of the children's initiations. It was for a 12-year-old girl named Reiki, a bold and fierce child. Freya said she would be honored to take part. For the event, Freya was dressed as Vuk, one of the five ghosts, and at midnight of the day of the ceremony, after everything else they did to celebrate, Reiki was helped into a spacesuit, and the faceplate of her helmet was blocked with a black cloth glued to it. They walked together to Spoke One, holding her by the arms. Up at the inner ring lock, they led her into the exterior lock, where they were all clipped into tethers. The air in the lock was sucked out, the outer lock door opened. They walked up a set of stairs and pushed off into the void of interstellar space, hanging there just sternward of the inner ring. The seven adults arranged themselves around Reiki, and one of them pulled off the black cloth covering her faceplate. And there she was, in space. Humans in interstellar space can see approximately 100,000 stars. The Milky Way appears as a broad white smear across the starry black. The starship has a silvery exterior that gleams faintly, but distinctly with reflected starlight. It is lit by the Milky Way more than by the other stars, so that the parts of the ship facing the Milky Way are distinctly lighter than parts facing away from it. People say that under the faint spangle of reflected starlight, the ship itself seems also to glow. Despite its great speed relative to the local backdrop, the only motion is of the entire starscape appearing to rotate around the ship, which is how the rotation of the ship is usually apprehended, the ship appearing still to the human observers as they move with it. At the time of Reiki's initiation, Tau Ceti was by far the brightest star around them, serving as their pole star ahead of the bow of the spine. As she saw all this, Reiki cried out, and then had to be held as she began flailing and screaming. Freya, dressed as Vuk, the wolfman, held her right arm in both hands and felt her tremble. Her parents and the other adults from the Yurt village explained to her what she was seeing, where they were going, what was happening. They chanted a chant they traditionally used to tell it all. Reiki groaned continuously through this chant. Freya was weeping. They all were weeping. After a while, they pulled themselves back in the lock. Then when the outer doors closed and air hissed back in, they got out of the spacesuits and clomped down the stairs back into the spoke and helped the traumatized girl walk home. Soon after this, Freya arranged to move on. The whole town came out for her farewell party, and many urged her to come back in the spring.
"Lots of young people circle the ring several times," she was told. "So be like them. Come back to us."
"I will," Freya said. The next day, she walked to the western end of the biome and passed through the open doorway into the short, tall tunnel between Labrador and the Pampas. This was the point where you could best see that the tunnels are canted at 15-degree angles to the biomes at each end. As she was leaving, a young man she had seen many times approached her.
"So you're leaving?"
"Yes."
"You saw Reiki's coming out?"
"Yes."
"That's why a lot of us hate this place."
Freya stared at him. "Why don't you leave then?"
"And go where?"
"Anywhere."
"You can't just go where you want to."
"Why not?"
"They won't let you. You have to have a place to go."
Freya said, "I left."
"But you're on your wander. Someone gave permission for you to go."
"I don't think so."
"Aren't you Devi's daughter?"
"Yes."
"They got you a permission. Not everyone gets them. Things wouldn't work if they did, don't you see? Everything we do is controlled. No one gets to do what they want. You have it a little different, but even you don't get to do what you want. That's why a lot of us hate this place, and Labrador especially. A lot of us would go to Costa Rica if we could."
In the Pampas, the sunline overhead was brighter, the blue of the ceiling a lighter pastel, the air full of birds. The land was flatter and set lower in its cylinder, farther away from its sunline, which meant it was a narrower parcel. Its greens were dustier but more widespread. Everything here was green. From the slight rise of the locked door, she could see up the whole length of the biome to the dark circle of the locked door leading to the prairie. There, on the rumpled plain of the Pampas, were roving herds, clouds of dust over each in the angled morning light. Cattle, elk, horses, deer. Like all the biomes, this one was a combination of wilderness, zoo, and farm. The two villages here, as in most of the biomes, were placed near the midline of the cylinder, not far from the locks at each end. Freya walked a path that ran parallel to the tram tracks. In the little village of Plata, a group of residents who had been informed she was coming greeted her and led her to a plaza. Here she was to live in rooms above a cafe. At the tables on the plaza outside the cafe, she was fed lunch and introduced by her hosts to many people of the town. They spent the afternoon telling her how wonderful Devi had been when a cistern of theirs had broken before Freya was born.
"A situation like that is when you really need your engineers to be good," they said. "So quick she was, so clever, so in tune with the ship, and so friendly too."
Freya nodded silently at these descriptions.
"I'm nothing like her," she told them. "I don't know how to do anything. You'll have to teach me something to do, but I warn you, I'm stupid."
They laughed at her and assured her they would teach her everything they knew, which would be easy, as it was so little.
"This is my kind of place, then," she said.
They wanted her to become a shepherd and a dairy worker if she didn't mind. Lots of people came to the pampas wanting to be a gaucho, to ride horses and throw bola balls at the legs of unfortunate calves. It was the signature activity of the pampas, and yet very seldom performed. The cows on the ship were an engineered breed, only about a sixth the size of cows back on Earth, and generally cared for in dairy pastures. So the big need was for people to go out with the sheep and let the sheepdogs know what needed doing. This was also an excellent opportunity for birdwatching, as the pampas were home to a large number of birds, including some very large and graceful, or some said graceless, cranes. Freya was agreeable. It would be better than the salmon factory, she told them. And as she was also to help in the cafe at night, she would get to see people and talk, as well as go out on the low green hills. So she settled in. She paid attention to the people in the cafe at night. It was noticeable that they tended not to disagree with her, and usually took a kind tone with her. They talked around her pretty often, but when she said something, the silences that followed were a bit longer than would be typical in a conversation. She was somehow irrefutable. Possibly it came from a feeling that she was in some way different. Possibly it was a form of respect for her mother. Possibly it was a result of her being taller than anyone else, a big young woman, said by many to be attractive. People looked at her. Eventually Freya herself noticed this.